I'd now like to welcome the witnesses on our first panel. And at this point, I will introduce the witness here in Washington, D.C., Alvin Toffler. I'm delighted that you're here, Alvin, and I would make my comments, frankly, about both you and Heidi, that you are among the world's most influential scholars and social thinkers. Their studies of the future, which have been read by presidents, prime ministers, and I might add the Speaker of the House, CEOs and students, are contemporary classics, which include Future Shock, Power Shift, The Third Wave, War and Anti-War, and Creating New Civilizations. Again, we're delighted that you're here, Alvin, and if you will go ahead with your testimony, we look forward to what you have to say.
Thank you, Senator. I'm honored to be here as part of this landmark hearing. I think that it is symbolic, as you say, of many of the things that we're going to be doing and experiencing in the years ahead, and it means a broadening of public access to and participation in the deliberations of the Congress. Symbolic, as I say, of the changes reshaping America in the years ahead. I will, in the interests of brevity, get down to some of the key points. The United States, ever since the mid-1950s, has been going through a fundamental transformation, economic, but not just economic, technological, but not just technological. We have been hit by an enormous series of changes since, roughly speaking, the mid-1950s. The period between 1955 and 1960, for example, just small examples, was the period when we first saw the universalization of television, the first commercial jet aviation, the landing of the Sputnik first probe into space. The birth control pill was introduced during that period. All of these, and of course the computer, began to move out of governmental and military applications into the business community as well. And so a whole series of very profound technological change struck America during that period, and have since then simply continued and multiplied. The consequence of this and non-technological changes is the emergence of a completely new kind of society.
Alvin, if I could, let me get you to bring the microphone a little closer and aim it up a little bit towards you. That's good.
Now, the consequence of this and a series of concomitant social and cultural changes have led to the emergence of a new kind of society, that we are no longer the industrial society that our parents grew up in. And part of that is a fundamental change in the nature of the economy. Many people, of course, now know the term third wave, but for those who don't, it'll simplify my further comments if I take 10 seconds to crudely define them. 10,000 years ago, we saw the beginnings of a transition from hunting and gathering to agricultural societies. That was the first wave of social transformation in human history. Roughly 300 years ago, the Industrial Revolution came and brought with it a fundamental change in the nature of society and of course, of economics, based in large measure on the application of technologies to the amplification of human muscle power. And starting roughly in the mid-50s and continuing on now and accelerating on down to now has been the introduction of the coming of a third wave of change based largely on technologies that amplify human mental or brain power rather than simply muscle power. And the consequence of these changes runs through every institution of the society. In 1970, when Future Shock was published, we first talked about what we call the general crisis of industrial society. And then in 1980, in the third wave, we talked about the coming decline of our basic industries and the rise of a whole set of new industries based on electronics, information, computing, space, and so on. It's now become a cliche to say that knowledge is the key to the economy. It's taken America about 20 or 30 years to recognize that idea. And yet, even today, most people do not appreciate the full meaning of that phrase. Why is knowledge so central to the economy, and why is it truly revolutionary? I'd like to begin with the factors of production. Most conventional economics textbooks, education and economics, begin with the idea that the factors of production are land, labor, and capital. Indeed, the fact is that today, any textbook which says land, labor, and capital are the factors of production ought to be thrown into the dustbin, because they omit the most fundamental factor of production of all, and that is knowledge. With the appropriate knowledge in the right heads at the right time and the right place, it is possible to substitute knowledge or information, and I'm using the terms loosely and interchangeably today, it is possible to substitute information for the amount of land, for the amount of capital, for the amount of labor, for the amount of raw materials, for the amount of energy, and for the amount of time required to produce anything. In fact, knowledge becomes the ultimate substitute for other factors of production. That is why it is the most important of the factors of production today. The very definition of economics is thus made obsolete. Economics has been defined as the science of the allocation of scarce resources, but knowledge is not a scarce resource. This fact alone should force us to change or redefine the entire vocabulary of economics, of second-wave economics. Words like productivity or consumer, concepts like gross domestic product or growth, all have to be re-examined and redefined, or indeed scrapped. The vast majority of U.S. employees today are, as we know, knowledge workers, and yet we do not know how to adequately measure information and knowledge productivity. We often are told that the services in which most Americans are employed are quote, unproductive. Very often that's because we're measuring the productivity using the tools of the second wave to assess an industry that is increasingly third wave. Or take the word production. What, in fact, is production? Imagine that General Motors made just one single car every year at a cost of billions of dollars, but that its customers could replicate that car at near zero cost and make their own cars. Now, in that case, who's producing what? Is it General Motors, or is it its customers as well? If so, how do you measure the productivity of the customer? As Alice in Wonderland might have said, it's curiouser and curiouser. And yet this is exactly what is now happening in one of America's most important industries, the software industry. When users copy software, is that copying part of production or consumption? And when replication of the tools we work with can be done at near zero cost, certainly some new rules need to apply. Information or knowledge is now as central to the U.S. economy as oil is to the Saudi Arabians or the Iranians or the Iraqis. And yet, unlike oil, it is very hard to contain. How should intellectual property be protected? Can it be, if we rely on traditional economic and legal definitions? These are only a few of the most obvious questions raised by the emergence of a third wave economy. In law, in accounting, and above all in economics, we need to develop a whole new set of third wave tools. If we look at fundamental aspects of the economy, we see these changes. Take the nature of capital itself. We're a capitalist society. We talk about capital. In first wave or agrarian societies, the only capital that really meant anything was land. If you had land, you ate and you had power. If you had no land, chances are your family went hungry for long periods of time and you were essentially powerless. Roughly speaking, that characterizes approximately 8 or 10,000 years of human social development. Now, the thing about land is that you could run it through your fingers, you can touch it, and if I grow a crop on my rice paddy or my acre, you cannot grow a crop on that rice paddy or acre. Then we came to second wave or industrial economics. We have a society based on smokestack production, assembly line production, and so on. And the dominant form of capital in that society is, say, shares of stock in a major American corporation, let's say General Motors or Bethlehem Steel. Notice that now what you have is a piece of paper. It is no longer the land directly, it's a symbol. But the symbol, your share certificate, represents your fractional ownership of buildings, assembly lines, trucks, raw material, inventory, in effect, physical assets, largely physical and tangible assets. Moreover, if I use the assembly line, you cannot use the assembly line at the same time. In that way, the fundamental nature of capital didn't change all that much when we shifted from land to industrial capital. Now, however, let's take a look at Microsoft. If I own a share of Microsoft, my share certificate is a symbol. But what is it a symbol of? Do I care if Microsoft has an assembly line, trucks, buildings, raw material, or any other physical assets for that matter? The answer is no, I don't. What I care about is what's inside the heads of Microsoft's people. And what is inside the heads of Microsoft people? Symbols, which means that my symbol or share of stock is a symbol of other symbols. Right now, we see IBM prepared to pay $3 billion something to Lotus for the symbols inside the heads of Lotus's people. But it isn't only capital that changes its character and becomes increasingly intangible. Money changes as we move to a third wave society. In most first wave societies, historically, money was something that had a utility other than its exchange value. For 10,000 years or so in Asia, the basic form of money was rice. If you couldn't exchange it, you could at least eat it. Other forms of money in the West were salt or calico, textiles, other things that had a utility other than the exchange value itself. In roughly the mid-1600s, at just about the time Newton was writing, just when the Industrial Revolution was gearing up in Britain and Western Europe, a writer named William Potter wrote an essay in which he said, "Someday money will be symbolic." My guess is nobody much understood what he meant until the American Revolution, when the Brits had managed to extract all the gold and silver, by and large, from the American colonies, and the American Continental Congress began printing paper money, which became one of the origins, at least, of the widespread use of paper money. And note that whereas before that, the value was based on how much you had, how big the how much rice you had, or how big or how much it weighed, now the value was not determined by that. The money had no utility other than exchange. The piece of paper it was printed on was useless. What you had was value based on numbers and letters printed on the paper. And those numbers and that presupposed a society in which at least some substantial number of people knew how to read, write, and count. What you had was money of the age of print. Today, as we know, the real money is not the dollar bills and the currency jingling in our pockets. It's plastic and it's electronic. It's digital and video money. In fact, we might say that there is a new law, and that a third wave law about money, and that is money is increasingly informationalized as information is increasingly monetized. A revolutionary upheaval in thinking about the nature of money in a third wave economy is now underway. But we can learn more about it from the pages of magazines like Wired or ASAP than from the economics journals. We're looking at new payment systems, digitalization, and a revolution in the nature of exchange. And yet, much of this, it seems to me, escapes the conventional economic literature. Another fundamental change that comes with the third wave economy, and indeed has a lot to do with its appearance in the first place, is what we in the third wave, written in 1980, defined as demassification. It's a big ugly word, but there was no word in the English language that otherwise conveyed the same meaning. The new economy is in part a direct result of the demassification of American society. What do we mean by that? A second wave or industrial society is a mass society. It's based on mass production, mass consumption, mass media, mass education, mass entertainment, and in some cases the weapons of mass destruction. A third wave society, the society that's now emerging, is a demassified society. And let me give you some examples of what I mean by that. Mass production, the purpose of mass production was always to turn out the largest possible run of identical objects. In fact, today, if we go to the advanced manufacturing facilities of the world, we find that that is not basically what they're engaged in. They are now capable of turning out 162 of this, 3,000 of that, two items of this, shift to 10,000 of that, and the back 168 of something else, continually altering the output. Now, the reason for that is the introduction of computerized information-based technology reduces the cost of variation. The cost of diversity is going down towards zero. And that means that instead of mass production, we're increasingly customizing production, turning out highly diverse, multiple products, and that is why Walmart, a typical Walmart store, can carry 110,000 different items. Siemens, the German electronics company, at one point a few years ago introduced a product called Lot Size 1, implying that it could produce one unit just as cheaply on a cost per unit basis as 10,000 or a million. The variety and customization is in fact made possible by rising by applications of sophisticated knowledge in the form of computerized production processes. But it isn't just manufacturing. If you look at the services, in 1900, every town in America had its own coffee roaster. Coffee tasted the same everywhere, different in every town. Then came General Foods and the other industrialized, food processing industries, and coffee began to taste the same all over the country. And there were relatively few choices. Now go to a Starbucks and take a look and see how many different kinds of coffee you can choose from. Diversity is replacing uniformity. Insurance policies, more different kinds. Financial instruments, more different kinds. Increasing customization, both in production of goods and in services. Again, much of this is made possible by applications of information technology and computerization, in fact, the hallmarks of the knowledge economy.
Mr. Topper, if I could, let me encourage you to wrap up. We've got Mr. Kotkin go to next.
This demassification is paralleled in marketing, it's paralleled in communication, where we have demassified media, it's paralleled in family structure, it's paralleled in culture. What is happening is that we're going from a mass society to an increasingly internally differentiated economy and society. And this explains in part why centralized economic management by central banks, governments, or planners is increasingly counterproductive. In a third wave economy, states, regions, and sectors will become more different from one another in terms of everything from available skills to environmental requirements. When interest rates, tax measures, and other centralist tools are employed to manage the macroeconomy, they produce increasingly different effects in different regions and sectors of the economy. Central management is like the doctor who prescribes the same medicine for all his patients. Adrenaline for everyone today, or everyone gets Valium tomorrow. These are just the initial and most obvious changes that come as we shift toward a knowledge-based economy. We change the nature of work, we change the scale of organization, we change the nature of organization, we change the speed of innovation, we change every element of the economy. And it is no exaggeration to describe this, in fact, as a revolution in economics, which has by and large not yet been adequately recognized by the economics profession. And I would urge, therefore, that this committee, given its mandate and its importance, play a critical role in accelerating the development of totally new third wave intellectual tools for understanding the emerging economy. I believe this committee has a unique opportunity to do that. The third wave transformation is not just economic. The changes you make in how you understand economics will have not just political impact, but immense social impact in the years to come as well. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this completes my testimony, and I look forward to any questions you may have.